Security Council. And then in 1999, Clinton led the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, which also violated the charter, killing about 500 civilians. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, called the UN a tool of American foreign policy.
Well, Marjorie, how about George Bush, George W. Bush? He invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. He was responsible, was he not, for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis?
That's true, Jim. And, you know, at the time, many people were saying, well, Bush's invasion of Iraq was illegal, but it was perfectly justifiable for him to invade Afghanistan after 9/11, and that is just false. In 2001, even though Afghanistan had not attacked the United States, Bush illegally invaded that country in retaliation for September 11th, 2001, where 19 men, 15 of whom came from Saudi Arabia, committed crimes against humanity in the United States. But that was not an armed attack by another state sufficient to trigger the Charter's Article 51 self-defense provision. It was not self-defense. The Security Council had not approved it. 2 years later, before he illegally invaded Iraq and changed its regime, Bush tried to obtain the consent of the Security Council, but the council refused to authorize his attack. So then Bush said, well, we have prior Security Council resolutions from the first Gulf War. Those would justify our attack in 2003. None of them authorized him to attack in 2003. So that was also an illegal war. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. during Bush's second term, and who later became national security advisor during Trump's first term, was John Bolton, the infamous John Bolton. And John Bolton displayed his hatred for the UN when he stated, quote, there is no such thing as the United Nations. If the UN Secretariat building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference.
Barack Obama launched drone strikes in 7 countries. Where were they? Please explain.
Yes. Well, he launched illegal drone strikes in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Libya, Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. None of those 7 states had attacked the U.S. or any other member country, and the Security Council did not authorize those strikes. The Obama administration didn't provide any evidence that any of them were about to launch an imminent attack on the United States, and even if the U.S. Congress had authorized Obama's wars, which they did not, that still would not have complied with the U.N. Charter.
And how about Donald Trump's first term as president? What countries did he attack?
Well, in 2017, Trump sent 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles to attack Syria in response to its alleged use of chemical weapons within Syria in a Damascus suburb. Syria had not attacked the U.S. or any other U.N. state before the missile strike, and the use of chemical weapons by Syria did not constitute an armed attack to trigger the right to self-defense. Then, in 2020, Trump ordered the illegal drone assassination of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani, who was at the time in Iraq. Neither Iran nor Iraq had attacked the United States, and the council had not authorized that drone attack, and therefore it was illegal under the charter.
Joe Biden mounted armed attacks against Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. Tell us about these, please.
Well, yes, Michael, 1 month after Biden was inaugurated, he authorized airstrikes in Syria on buildings that purportedly belonged to Iran-backed militia who were allegedly responsible for attacks against U.S. and allied personnel in Iraq. But Syria had not mounted an armed attack on the U.S. or any other country, and the Security Council had not approved the attack. And those, of course, are the only two instances where it's lawful under the U.N. Charter to attack another country. So that violated the U.N. Charter. And Biden also authorized illegal drone strikes in Afghanistan in 2021 and 2022 and in Yemen in 2024. None of them were mounted in self-defense. None of them were approved by the Security Council. So they were illegal.
Well, then, Marjorie, that brings us to Trump's second term. So far, he has attacked Iran and Venezuelan vessels at sea. What were the circumstances?
Well, first of all, Jim, I want to say that Trump signed an executive order trying to rename the Department of Defense as the Department of War. Only Congress can do that, but nevertheless, that move indicates Trump's explicit rejection of the Charter's fundamental precept of self-defense. And his actions since assuming office for his second term, which have not even been a year now, are consistent with that rejection of the Charter's prohibition on the use of force. After Israel illegally attacked Iran in June, Trump conducted a series of military strikes against three Iranian nuclear facilities. And Trump claimed that he was going to put a stop to the nuclear threat posed by the world's number one state sponsor of terror, and that's a quote from Trump. But Iran was not an imminent threat. The director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran didn't even have nuclear weapons capabilities. And so the U.S. strikes were not mounted in self-defense, and the council had not given its blessing for the attacks. Last month, Trump illegally ordered armed attacks on at least three Venezuelan fishing vessels under the guise of fighting the drug war, killing at least 11 people. That was the first strike. We don't know how many people were killed by the other two, and there may have been more. In direct violation of the UN Charter, and I could say cynically that Trump was testing the waters, because NBC News is reporting that Trump is considering mounting drug strikes within Venezuela itself in the next few weeks, which would be totally illegal under the UN Charter.
Marjorie, let's turn to the petition that Taxpayers Against Genocide and Palestinian Americans plan to file tomorrow in the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights. Can you please explain to our listeners what the commission is and what it does?
Well, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights is the official human rights body in the Western Hemisphere that was established by the Organization of American States. And its document that's relevant here is the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, which sets forth the jurisprudence of the commission and the Inter-American Court on Human Rights as well, and binds the OAS member states, including the U.S. So the United States is bound by it. And that is one of the main documents, one of the main treaties contained within this petition that you referred to. Now, although the commission cannot criminally prosecute U.S. officials, it can determine that the U.S. government is guilty of violating its international obligations. And a finding of guilt of the U.S. government by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights can be used by human rights advocates in their other efforts to hold the U.S. government accountable on an international level.
Well, what about this Taxpayers Against Genocide? What is it? When was it established? And what kinds of legal actions has it taken to hold the U.S. officials accountable for their, well, complicity in Israel's genocide?
Well, Jim, the Taxpayers Against Genocide is an expanding grassroots movement that now represents more than 4,000 taxpayers across the U.S., as well as several Palestinian Americans who brought the petition on behalf of themselves and the Palestinians in Gaza. The Taxpayers Against Genocide was established 1 year ago when activists in Northern California counties united to launch a historic class action lawsuit against their congresspersons for illegally using their tax dollars to fund the genocide in Palestine. And in February, a U.S. district judge dismissed the lawsuit by the taxpayers on the grounds that it raised a political question. In other words, that foreign policy determinations are limited to the executive and legislative branches, even though genocide is a judicial question because there are laws that prevent genocide. Well, on April 7th, the Taxpayers Against Genocide filed an unprecedented report with the UN Human Rights Council, charging U.S. officials with direct participation in the genocide. And the report documents how both the Biden and the Trump administrations, in concert with specific members of Congress, used U.S. tax dollars to finance genocide and war crimes in violation of the Constitution, federal laws, and the Genocide Convention. Now, this report that the taxpayers filed will be included in what's called the Universal Periodic Review on the U.S. human rights record. The Universal Periodic Review calls on each of the 193 U.N. member states to submit a peer review of its human rights records every 4.5 years. And then every state receives reports and recommendations from other U.N. member states, civil society, NGOs for improvement. But on August 28th, in an unprecedented move, the Trump administration announced that it will boycott Universal Periodic Review process. This is the first time in history that a state has refused to participate in a review of its own human rights record.
Well, Marjorie, before I ask you the next question on what evidence does the new petition add, I just wanted to remind our listeners that this is Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're interviewing the very fine international lawyer, Marjorie Cohn, on the situation with the United Nations. It seems to us, Marjorie, that the United States has done over the last 5 presidential inaugurations and positions, what they've done is they've attempted to really destroy the United Nations. Marjorie, what evidence does the new petition add?
Yes, and I agree with you, Michael. That certainly does look like that's what they're trying to do. This new petition adds voluminous new evidence of the U.S. role in causing the escalating starvation in Gaza, and also the U.S. provision of thousands of bombs and munitions to exterminate the mostly unarmed civilians in Gaza, as well as U.S. organizational and logistical help to establish the notorious Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which we'll talk about in a minute, and many other atrocities and massacres. The petition cites the nearly $3.8 billion a year the U.S. gives Israel, as well as at least $17 billion the U.S. has given Israel since October 7th, 2023. The U.S. provides weaponry, technology, funding, and diplomatic cover for Israel's genocide. The U.S. has entwined itself in Israel's genocidal machinery, the petition says, turning what might have been a short-lived offensive into a protracted campaign of annihilation conducted with impunity. The petition cites Israel's widespread, indiscriminate, and disproportionate attacks, disabling most of Gaza's hospitals and damaging approximately 97% of its schools, devastating civilian infrastructure across Gaza, and damaging or destroying about 90% of all housing units in Gaza. In addition, Israel has dramatically intensified its closure regime on Gaza, severely restricting or entirely cutting off the entry of essential goods that includes food, water, fuel, electricity, and medicine, and other humanitarian aid.
Well, Marjorie, you mentioned the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. What is it? What has been its role with respect to the Israeli genocide in Gaza?
Well, on March the 2nd, Israel declared a total blockade of any food, medicine, water, fuel entering Gaza. After almost 4 months of the total blockade, the U.S. sponsored and financed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation came in to replace the UN, which was providing humanitarian aid to people in Gaza. And this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is a militarized aid distribution system, and it has exacerbated the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. It attracts desperate Gazans seeking food, and then it kills many of them when they arrive to obtain vital aid. As of August 17th, at least 1,857 Palestinians have been killed while seeking food, over 1,000 of them in the vicinity of this so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites, and 836 along the routes of food convoys. As of August 22nd, 514,000 people, a quarter of all Palestinians in Gaza, were experiencing catastrophic famine, characterized by starvation, destitution, and death. That's what the petition says.
Really, I think one of the great crimes against humanity ever. Marjorie Cohn, the new petition requests that the commission order, quote, precautionary measures to accelerate the legal processing of the petition by the commission. What are the precautionary measures that the petitioners seek?
Well, Michael, first, to ensure the immediate protection of life and integrity, at a minimum, suspend all weapons transfers from the U.S. to Israel. Second, guarantee unhindered access to humanitarian aid, the immediate dismantling of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and U.S. support for the unhindered operation of human rights groups, including the UN Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, which used to provide the humanitarian assistance until the U.S. And Israel deep-sixed it. Third, suspend arms transfers pending review of their complicity in the genocide. Fourth, cancel the sanctions on the International Criminal Court and the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese, to ensure that these independent bodies can carry out their investigations and monitoring without interference or obstruction. What the U.S. has done is blocked property and assets in the U.S. and suspended entry into the U.S. for anyone connected with the investigation in the International Criminal Court on Israeli leaders' participation in the genocide, and also civil sanctions for anyone who helps the ICC investigate Israeli leaders for genocide. Number five, cooperate fully with all UN mechanisms to ensure independent investigation, accountability, and enforcement of the provisional measures ordered by the International Court of Justice, the World Court. And six, suspend or prevent acts leading to irreparable harm. In other words, cease military support to Israel and obstruction of accountability measures in the UN Security Council and punitive actions that are designed to silence advocacy for Palestinian rights within the U.S. And that, of course, is taking place on the campuses with journalists, with the immigration policy, the deportation policy, et cetera. And then finally, facilitate periodic reporting and oversight by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The U.S. Must submit regular detailed reports about its progress.
Marjorie, there are so many aspects of the work of the United Nations, but when it comes to the matter of wars and peacekeeping, which was certainly a central focus of why it was created in the first place, what is your assessment of what kind of a job it's empowered and able to do in those regards?
Well, certainly the structure of the UN, which is the five permanent members, each of which have a veto power, was there from the get-go in 1945 when they created the UN, and the victorious powers from World War II would not have signed on if they didn't have that power. But there is a lot that we can do, and one of the things that civil society does is what's called the mobilization of shame, which means to shame countries like Israel, like the United States, that commit these atrocious crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in the eyes of the world. It's impossible to ignore what Israel, with U.S. assistance, is doing in Gaza, and there are mass movements all over the world, and boycotts, and the flotilla, getting tremendous publicity, putting pressure on the Israeli and U.S. leaders, and getting the word out, and programs like Law and Disorder Radio, places like Truth Out and Sheer Post, where I publish articles. So I think that while it seems discouraging, we can't underestimate the power of the people and civil society to put pressure on these genocidal countries and leaders to back down.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Where can our listeners in general follow your work? I know you do a good deal of writing. If our listeners wanted to learn more about your work and your writings, where might they go for that?
Well, I have a regular column called Human Rights and Global Wrongs on truthout.org. And so if you go to truthout.org and go to the very bottom and look on, click on Human Rights and Global Wrongs, all my articles that have been published on Truthout are there. But all of my articles and books and many of my interviews are posted on my own website, which is called MarjorieCohn.com.
MarjorieCohn.com, that's easy enough. Well, Marjorie, it's been wonderful having you back with us again on Law and Disorder. And your expertise in the matters in which we're discussing today are really unparalleled. We thank you so much for joining us and sharing that information with us.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for your incredible work and for keeping Law and Disorder in the national and international consciousness for so many years. And so I salute you, and thank you again for having me back.
Thank you, Marjorie. You take it easy.
You too, Michael. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Sharon Kyle is the publisher of the LA Progressive. She's written a couple of fine articles about racism in American life recently in that publication. One of them, written at the end of August, is entitled Lisa Cook as low-hanging fruit, while Jerome Powell is a bridge too far. She maintains that when political commentators and the corporate media describe Cook as low-hanging fruit, they expose the racism in American life and politics. So we've invited Sharon Kyle to be our guest today to explain her claim of racism in connection with Trump's efforts to get rid of Cook on that vitally important Federal Reserve Board, and replace her with someone who would do his bidding. Sharon Kyle is not only the publisher of the LA Progressive, a must-read online daily newsletter for all serious political thinkers and activists in around LA, she's also the former president of People's College of Law, a former member of the board of directors of the ACLU of Southern California, and is on the editorial board of the BlackCommentator.com. Well, Sharon Kyle, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sharon, I think we should start off with this. Just quickly remind our audience what the Federal Reserve Board is and what its chief function is.
So the Federal Reserve is a system that was created in response to repeated banking crises. It was created through an act of Congress. The act is called the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
It's no secret that Trump has wanted to get rid of Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve Board, and replace him with someone who will do his bidding on the setting of interest rates. Why has he not been able to do this?
Well, hi, Michael. There are a couple of ways to answer that question, and I address both in the piece that I wrote on the LA Progressive that kind of spawned this conversation. But let's just talk about the first. The Federal Reserve, as I said, was created by an act of Congress. And in that act that was established in 1913, they specifically state that there are limits, legal limits, on how a Federal Reserve governor can be removed. So the law says Federal Reserve governors, including the chair, can only be removed for cause. So that term, for cause, that means that there must be actual misconduct or incapacity. Now, incapacity could be any number of things, but it basically means that the governor no longer has the capacity to do the job. Maybe they were in a car accident or had some kind of brain injury. That's what incapacity means. But you cannot remove a governor because you disagree with their policies. So the courts have historically interpreted for cause as a very high bar, protecting the Fed from political retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sharon, therefore, Trump not being able to get rid of Powell, you argue that Trump is now going after Lisa Cook because she is in the, as the corporate media puts it, quote-unquote, low-hanging fruit. Besides her race, is it not also the case that she is low-hanging fruit, at least in part because she has no political clout, no real base among the Republicans? Talk to us about that.
Yes, I'll talk to you about that. But before I do, I want to emphasize that the reason I wrote this piece is because I had watched several interviews of politicians and talking heads on television, and they continued to refer to Lisa Cook as low-hanging fruit. And what it did for me, it revealed the tacit acceptance that a Black woman's place is always more precarious, always more expendable. So, Jim, as you mentioned, perhaps she's low-hanging fruit because of her lack of political clout, or she has no real base among Republicans. Well, if you take that to its furthest logical conclusion, you can probably see that that too, no political clout and no real base among Republicans, those too are driven by her race. But let's get back to the fact that she is the first Black woman on the Fed board. It has strong symbolic importance, but fewer entrenched allies in financial institutions. So she, although symbolically, having a Black woman on the Fed board tells a story. It creates this narrative that the United States likes to project that we are beyond race. But we know that that's not true, because if we look at the numbers, we can see that Black people rank lower on every index that indicates financial well-being, psychological, educational. But Lisa Cook has fewer entrenched allies in financial institutions. This is true. While Jerome Powell, as chair, has Wall Street, central bankers, and bipartisan senators ready to defend him. And that makes removal of Jerome Powell much more riskier to Donald Trump, even though Jerome Powell is the primary target that Trump would like to go after.
Sharon, your article also says Cook is designated by the media as low-hanging fruit because she is the first Black woman to ever serve on the Federal Reserve Board. Why do you make the claim that her race is the real reason Trump sees her as vulnerable?
Trump's choice of Lisa Cook is not random. It reflects a shrewd, if not cynical, calculation that American racism and sexism will lower the political cost of attacking her. Trump knows that going directly after Jerome Powell, a white male Fed chair with Wall Street allies and bipartisan defenders, risks a unified backlash from the establishment. Targeting Lisa Cook, by contrast, lets him test the boundaries of presidential removal power on someone with fewer entrenched defenders, as I've mentioned, not because she's less qualified, but because racism and sexism erode her perceived legitimacy in the public's eyes.
Well, but Sharon, is it not also the case, though, that in addition to being Black, and the first Black woman on the Federal Reserve Board, that in addition to that, she's also caught up in some sort of claim of mortgage fraud. Talk to us about this aspect of the matter.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing up that mortgage fraud. So in writing the article that led to this discussion, I was particularly interested in the ways in which information of this type happens to cross Donald Trump's path, because it's unlikely that the president of the United States is in the business of reviewing old mortgage applications. We're talking about a mortgage application that happened about 4 or 5 years ago. So it turns out that the accusation against Cook came from a document called a criminal referral that was prepared by a man named William Polt. And Trump appointed William Polt as director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which other politicians have been targeted by Trump by the same allegation after Bolte became the chair of this Federal Housing Finance Agency. So the short version is, besides Cook, Trump's Federal Housing Finance Agency director has provided information on Letitia James, similar kind of information, classifying it as mortgage fraud. Letitia James, everyone will know, is the New York Attorney General. He's done the same thing with Adam Schiff, who is a California United States Senator. And in both cases, he has personal issues because both Letitia James and Adam Smith have played a role in bringing forward charges against Trump or investigating Trump. The thing with this mortgage fraud is they are accused of indicating that the houses that they were applying for a mortgage for were their primary residences. And what I've learned is it's simply a matter of checking off a box. Now, I don't know how many people listening out there have purchase real estate. I have, and I'm telling you the number of documents that you have to sign or check boxes on, it could be hundreds. It's very easy, I would think, to check the wrong box. But in the case of Lisa Cook, in other statements, she clearly stated that the property that they are claiming that she was identifying as a primary residence, she clearly stated it as a secondary residence in other documents. So it could just be simply a matter of checking the wrong box. The question is whether or not this is a matter that is for cause. She was never convicted of any wrongdoing. It's simply an accusation. She hasn't had due process. The case is very weak, which leads me to back to race and gender.
Sharon, you also contend that Cook's initial lack of institutional visibility makes her an easier target. Talk to us about that, please.
One of the things that I talk about in the piece is Cook's credentials, her experience, her education, and her training. In some instances, she is described as being much more qualified for the position than many other governors. And some have even said that her qualifications are more powerful than Powell's. So, I'm sorry, re-ask the question, please. As chair of the Federal Reserve, he is the most visible figure in monetary policy. Removing him would instantly send markets into turmoil, threaten global financial stability, and provoke backlash from Wall Street. And even international allies would be impacted with Powell as chair of the Federal Reserve. Cook, on the other hand, is one of seven governors. She's important, but not the public face of the Fed. Removing her would not immediately shake global confidence in the dollar in the same way. That lower profile makes her a softer target.
Well, then also, Sharon, your article makes the point that it's caught up in Trump's war on DEI, that is diversity, equity, and inclusion, that the DEI fight that Trump is engaged in factors into the targeting of Lisa Cook. Talk to us about that.
Right. So there is an anti-DEI climate. When Trump came into office, he immediately signed an executive order that eradicates DEI in the federal government. Both the DEI programs and also people employed in the federal government that were running the DEI programs. What has happened since Trump has been in office is this anti-DEI climate has created a climate where people like Lisa Cook, people like Letitia James, are beginning to be identified as people who are in office, not because they merit, not because they have the credentials, not because they have the experience, but because somehow they were given these positions because of their color. The climate of getting rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion as a means to return to a merit-based selection, that belief system supports and renders Lisa Cook less eligible for protection.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Sharon Kyle on the Lisa Cook scandal. Sharon, finally, on the matter of the targeting of Lisa Cook, in an effort to get rid of her and get her off the Federal Reserve Board, what do you think it says about the broader stakes involved in the effort to get rid of her? What are those broader stakes?
Right. So Trump is using this personal misconduct narrative, the mortgage fraud referral, as a way to pry open the Fed's legal protections. So while I believe that Lisa Cook is low-hanging fruit, I absolutely believe that Trump has a bigger target in mind, and that is to establish a precedent with the aim of turning this precedent into the normalizing of the president taking control of an independent central bank. We should expect copy-paste attempts across other independent agencies if Trump is successful. So as it stands today, Donald Trump has not been successful with the removal of Lisa Cook. A lower court issued an injunction, and they're waiting for the Supreme Court to make a final decision. So this is where things stand. On September the 9th, the lower court issued a preliminary injunction blocking President Trump from removing Lisa Cook while the legal challenge proceeds. On September the 15th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. Circuit rejected the Trump administration's request for emergency relief. So the Trump administration was attempting to go around that temporary injunction, but on September the 15th, the U.S. Court of Appeals said, no, you can't do that. Then just yesterday, on October the 1st, the United States Supreme Court declined to grant Trump's emergency appeal, effectively keeping Cook in her position for now. But the U.S. Supreme Court scheduled oral arguments for January 2026 to decide the core issue. And the core issue is whether or not Trump has lawful cause to remove her. So the court's most recent determination, Lisa Cook remains as Fed governor for now, but they have delayed making a final decision about whether or not the president of the United States can lawfully remove someone from an independent agency.
With respect to that, just last Thursday, a group of the nation's top former economic policymakers warned the Supreme Court not to allow Trump to fire Lisa Cook. This was a rather hopeful development, wasn't it?
It kind of depends on what you mean by hopeful. So yes, in a sense, it is hopeful that they didn't just grant him his wishes, as has happened in the past. But again, what has happened with the Supreme Court decision is that that decision was ruled in a shadow docket. So the shadow docket refers to the court's practice of deciding through short, unsigned orders without full briefing or oral argument, which is why I can't really say whether or not this is a good sign or a bad sign. The decision that they made yesterday gives us no indication because we don't have a full briefing or an oral argument to rely on to glean anything that would tell us how the court is going to rule when the core matter is picked up again in January of 2026.
Sharon, in another of your recent articles in the LA Progressive, is one entitled, quote, "The Trump Administration, White Supremacy in Action." In summary form, can you please make the case in support of that title and in support of your claim that Trump's administration is an example of white supremacy in action?
The question is about the article that I wrote, which is a different article, not the Lisa Cook article. The article is "The Trump Administration, White Supremacy in Action." And in that piece, what I am addressing is the flagrant, what I believe is flagrant, white supremacy. So the Trump administration has issued many executive orders, have made many statements. And I'm just going to give you a sense of how this lands with this Black woman, which is what I am. How does it land with me when I hear statements such as Trump's challenge of the Central Park Five? And I'm going back to Trump's history. The Central Park Five were a group of young, when I say young, I mean minors. These were teenagers, and I think maybe one may have been 20 years old, Black men in New York City who were accused of doing a heinous crime to a young white woman, a jogger in Central Park. And it turns out that there really was no strong evidence against them. DNA evidence exonerated them, and Trump wanted these young five men to be put to death. He wanted them to be sentenced to the death penalty, and they were all Black and Latino teens. Even after the DNA evidence showed they could not have possibly done this, when Trump came down the aisle, I'm just going to just go through a list of reasons that I say that Trump's public statements and some of his executive decisions are clearly racist. Trump's description of Mexicans in his 2015 presidential election campaign, he frequently referred to Mexican immigrants as criminals and rapists while presenting himself as the solution. Shortly after he was elected during his first administration, one of the first things that he did was ban Muslims. The way that he talked after the terrible incident in Charlottesville in 2017, after white supremacists marched chanting, "Jews will not replace us," Trump insisted that there were very fine people on both sides. His characterization of countries from Africa and the Caribbean, he characterized them as asshole countries. His attack on Judge Gonzalo Curiel, a claimed federal judge, he claimed that this federal judge could not rule fairly because of his Mexican heritage. His Family Separation Act at the border instituted a zero tolerance immigration policy that deliberately separated thousands of migrant children, mostly from Central America, separated them from their parents. Housing discrimination, publicly known. He had a real estate involvement. He owned a building that he and his dad systematically, intentionally refused to rent to Black tenants. They were sued for this, and they were found culpable in this kind of activity. Attacks on voting rights. He supported and amplified false claims of widespread voter fraud, often accusing and focusing cities with large Black populations. The erasing of DEI, I've already talked about that. Targeting critical race theory, issued an executive order banning federal agencies and contractors from diversity training that included any discussions of critical race theory. In addition to Trump, his allies, his minions that I like to call, Stephen Miller's immigration agenda, Trump's senior advisor has engineered policies aimed at slashing legal immigration, reducing refugee admissions, and eliminating asylum protections from people coming from south of the border. Use of far-right militias. Trump told the Proud Boys, a group tied to white nationalism, to stand back and stand by during a 2020 debate. His January 6th insurrection targeting Stop the Steal narrative was focused on delegitimizing heavily Black, Latino, Native American voting districts that delivered Biden's victory.
Well, Sharon, it's been wonderful talking to you today, but remind our listeners, first of all, what the LA Progressive is, the publication that you're the publisher of, how they might go about getting it or subscribing it to us, and any other last comments you'd care to make.
Thank you, Jim. So the LA Progressive can be found at laprogressive.com. It's a daily digital magazine. I'm the publisher. My husband is the editor. And we have been running this digital magazine for more than 18 years. It didn't start out that we actually had no intention of doing it for this long. But our political climate is such that we feel compelled to deliver content every single day. We also have a podcast and a YouTube channel, and we're all over social media. So if you just do a search for LA Progressive or Sharon Kyle or Dick and Sharon, you will find us somewhere on the internet.
Indeed you will, and it's a wonderful publication.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, we have published close to 50,000 articles in these 18 years. And I would say that I have gotten quite an education. Our writers come from all over the countries. Many are professors. Many have worked with other publications, or because, you know, print media was beginning to die like 18 years ago. And many of the writers retired people from print media, or people who just felt like they just had to keep writing, and they discovered us, they found us, and they provide content for us every single day.
Absolutely. Well, Sharon Kyle, we thank you so much for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Sharon.
We'd like to take a moment now to note the passing of a great American political activist, Assata Shakur. Assata Shakur has died. She died in exile 2 weeks ago in Havana, Cuba. A political refugee, she had been granted political asylum under international law by a sympathetic Cuban government. She was 78 years old. Assata Shakur was an almost mythical figure among movement people in the United States. She was born in Jamaica, Queens, in 1947. She later became an activist against the American war against the Vietnamese people's fight for self-determination. She supported the Cuban Revolution, and she actively opposed the apartheid government in South Africa. Assata joined the Black Panther Party, which was destroyed by the American government's COINTEL program, an effort initiated by racist FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and designed really to neutralize the leaders of the Black movement for self-determination in America. Assata Shakur then joined a small group called the Black Liberation Army. In 1974, she was shot in the back and in the arm after a car in which she was a passenger was stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike. She was gravely injured and captured. And despite a shattered shoulder bone, she was accused of hoisting a gun and shooting a state trooper, really an impossibility given her physical condition. She was nevertheless tried by an all-white jury, convicted and sentenced to life in prison plus 30 years. Assata Shakur was kept in solitary and tortured in an all-men's prison. She was liberated by comrades 6 years later, where she fled to Cuba, which welcomed her and gave her asylum. The state of New Jersey, nevertheless, along with the FBI, put a target on her back by offering a $2 million bounty for her capture, dead or alive. When Michael Ratner and my co-host Michael Smith wrote a book about how and why the CIA assassinated Che Guevara, the Cubans published it. And they had a book launch in Havana. Well, Assata Shakur bravely came, exposing herself to danger, but nevertheless wanted to show her solidarity with their efforts to expose the crimes of the CIA. And so we say goodbye to this great woman, acknowledging her and the example of courage and humanity that Assata Shakur set for all of us.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Many, many ways in which a society is gagged. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship.
That's P. Sineth, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features P. Sineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style. India, the world's most populous country, is ruled by Narendra Modi, who is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. He first became prime minister in 2014 and has been re-elected twice since, though in 2024 with much lower margins. Before coming to power in Delhi, he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where he presided over a major massacre of Muslims. Modi and the BJP promote Hindutva, Hindu majoritarianism. It is laced with Islamophobia. Modi is allied with India's billionaire class, who control the country's major media and function as cheerleaders for a regime that gags democracy, free speech, and dissent. Our guest today is P. Sineth. He's an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. "I cover the people," he says, "who live at the bottom end of the spectrum." He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. He gave the Hari Sharma Memorial Lecture at the Surrey Public Library in Surrey, British Columbia, in early October. And now, P. Sineth, Gagging Democracy, India Style.
A few months ago, just before the national elections, our Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, discovered and declared that he had understood after his mother's passing that he was not biologically born. Yeah? And had in fact been installed by God to show all the rest of us whatever he has been showing us. So when we are talking about governance by gagging, and I'm going to race a bit, there are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. And one of them you saw immediately after that wonderful statement of the Prime Minister. Not a single newspaper wrote a single editorial, not a single anchor on any channel made any kind of critical comment when the head of the nation says that he is non-biologically born. You know, it's just as if they didn't hear it. He said it out loud and clear. The gagging is of a particular, of one of the five types that I'm going to talk about. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra-legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media, which, like in the case of the prime ministers, not biologically born and of divine origin. I mean, I think there were at least some interesting doctrines to be gone into when you are of divine origin. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality, which to my mind is the main source of the gagging, because it didn't just start on 2014 with Mr. Modi. That's not true. That's not accurate. It's been going on. It's raced in the time of Mr. Modi, but ever since we embraced neoliberalism in 1991, the different sources of gagging have grown immeasurably. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship. The fear. How many people who know better are remaining silent because it's bloody prudent and sensible to remain silent. Okay, so those are broadly the five ways. Let me show you the first, gagging by laws. And, you know, one of the ways of silencing people is that it requires just the selective silence of the judiciary. Would you believe that the Delhi High Court has held that Inquilab Zindabad is an incendiary and inflammatory statement, and you can go to jail for it if they feel that you used it in a violent context. Inquilab Zindabad, coined by Maulana Hasrat Mohani, was the rallying cry of the Indian freedom struggle. Long live the revolution. Here is the Delhi High Court. This is in the case of poor Umar Khaled. Umar Khaled has been denied bail I don't know how many times. And one of his problems, of course, is that he has a Muslim name. That's a serious issue and indicative, doubtless, of criminality. So look at what they're saying here. Huh? During the course of argument, issues were raised relating to the content, context, and use of certain phraseology in the speech of the appellant. This is the High Court of Delhi, which prima facie appears to be incriminating per se, as also as inflammatory. The court goes on to say, however, this court is not impressed by the argument of the appellant, inasmuch as the call to revolution does not have to affect only the immediate gathering. The call to revolution may affect many beyond those who were visibly present, which is why this court finds it apt to mention Robespierre, who was at the vanguard of the French Revolution. This court is of the view that possibly, if the appellant had referred to Maximilien Robespierre for what he meant by revolution, he must have also known what revolution meant for our freedom fighter and first prime minister. The very fact that Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru believed that democracy had made revolution superfluous, by the way, Nehru used that slogan many times himself in the 30s. That democracy has made revolution superfluous after independence, and how it meant to the complete opposite of a bloodless change. Revolution isn't by itself always bloodless, which is why it is contradistinctly used with the prefix of bloodless revolution. So when we use the expression revolution, it is not necessarily bloodless. They're finding a way to say that Umar Khaled's slogan, Inquilab Zindabad, which is in every Indian trade union meeting that you can imagine at the beginning and at the end, was somehow an incitement to violence. A revolution in its essential quality may not be different, but from the point of view of Robespierre and Pandit Nehru, in its potentiality, blah, blah. The accompanying documents and in view of the discussions herein, only for the limited percent of the present bail, this court expresses the inescapable conclusion that allegations against the appellant are prima facie true. And hence, the embargo created by section whatever of the UAPA is the most draconian of laws, Unlawful Activities Prevention Act in India, under which they brought to this horrible law of 1967, they brought amendments in 2019, which enable the police to charge or government to characterize an individual as terrorist. That was actually meant for organizations. They can now term anyone, an individual, a terrorist. And like they have with Umar Khaled and others. Thus, the appellant's application seeking regular bail is rejected. Did you ever believe that in your lifetime that a court would say Inquilab Zindabad is incriminatory and inflammatory? So there you are with this incredible situation where hundreds of people are arrested arbitrarily. They don't get bail. Meanwhile, when someone else comes up who is not objectionable to the government, the court issues bail with pious injunctions like bail is the rule, jail is the exception. A Supreme Court judge has gone on record saying that in the UAPA, jail is the rule, bail is the exception. On October 3, we observed the first anniversary of the biggest raid on journalists in Indian history. There was much worse done to journalists under colonial rule, and there were a lot of terrible things done to journalists during the political emergency. of 75, 79. But it never happened. It never happened that 46 journalists associated with a single publication in a single city were raided by nearly 500 policemen at dawn. This was the journalists associated with NewsClick. Also, every electronic device they owned was confiscated. Some of them have still not got it back. Hard disks, laptops, mobile phones, the whole works. And the courts did not raise a finger to protest against this. Yeah. So there you have one very clear form of gagging. If you look at this, the court holds that the Delhi police charge of terrorism against Umar Khalid are prima facie true. And therefore, there is no way it will give him bail. This is the High Court of Delhi. In the emergency, you know, every year, every June 25th, all over India, we have commemorative meetings to remember the declaration of the emergency, June 25, 1975, and that we shall never have it again. Now, the tragedy with this, as much as I attend those meetings and make speeches at them myself, the tragedy is every year, that single day, we ritualize our remembrance of the emergency. Every year, on that single day, we ritualize our rejection of the emergency. But almost every day, every year since, we institutionalize our embrace of it through new laws, through amendments, like the unlawful activities public. So we've rebuilt emergency in far more lethal form through a number of little laws and amendments and stuff, some of which I'll come to when we come to corporate media and how the government works in sync with it. What do we mean by governance, by gagging? You have seen the laws. By the way, governance is no longer refers to governments alone. There are many other institutional players in governance.
WRTP Pittsburgh, your oil revival station.